Welcome to The Upper Hand, where Chuck and Chris talk hand surgery.
We are two hand surgeons at Washington University in St. Louis, here to talk about all aspects of hand surgery, from technical to personal.
Thank you for subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
And be sure to leave a review. That helps us get the word out.
Oh, hey, Chris.
Hey, Chuck. How are you?
I'm pretty well. Good morning.
Good morning. It's a Saturday morning, and I will say we're starting early, but you wanted to start earlier than this.
Well, I have a busy day. It's going to be a great weekend. My middle daughter is graduating from high school, and so I think it was really important that I exit the house, get some stuff done, and then re-enter the house before the family wakes up.
Now, the reason why I didn't want to start earlier than this is that I knew to have the energy to do this so early, I needed to exercise first. So I just hit the bike.
Oh, wow.
And now we're talking because I am actually a functioning human after I exercise.
So what time did you jump on the bike? I'm curious.
5:30.
Ah, and who'd you do and how long did you ride?
I rode for 30 minutes with Leanne Hainsby from the UK. And then I did a little strength exercise after that because I realized recently that I was doing too much just biking, mainly because I just enjoy zoning out on the bike, and I needed to do something else. So I did a little strength training. One thing that we talked about before was managing energy. And it's interesting that we have so much time to do this podcast every week, but then I get this Outlook invite sent from your administrative executive saying that we needed to schedule an hour to talk about the podcast.
Well, the podcast and other things, it is really funny because I wouldn't say that we easily find time for the podcast. I think we do get up super early on a Saturday and we struggle. And I do think as we strategize the podcast and some other things, finding time during our workday really is going to feel like a good meeting. We're going to sit down together, which we haven't done in a while, maybe have a cup of coffee. I think the formality of it all will hopefully lead to a great meeting.
Absolutely. Well, let's say we don't find time for the podcast. I think we make time for the podcast.
That is very, very true.
So I had a really interesting case to follow up on our recent discussion about radial tunnel syndrome. And the technical aspects of that approach. So I do a lot of nerve surgery. And one of our partners, kind of many years ago, had called me in because a patient had, they were doing a both bone forearm ORIF in an adult. And, I think somebody had gotten a little too close to the superficial radial nerve, put it that way. And, the thought was, well, just the skin nerve. And I cringed as soon as they said that. And I'm like, oh, but, I said, okay. At this point, I did a little intramuscular transposition because that's all I could do at the time because, there was nothing else to do. It was an intra-op consult. The patient comes back and does have pain. And typically that intramuscular transposition has done pretty well for me. But persistent pain, and it's been a couple of years, and I did the standard workup, including, a diagnostic block. What's been your go-to in terms of that kind of thing before you would just send it to your partners?
Well, I like that latter option. Explain to me what you mean by an intramuscular transfer of the superficial branch of the radial nerve specifically?
So the SRN after the PIN and after any motor branches when it's purely a sensory nerve. I think it's been pretty reliable to treat a painful neuroma or to treat what you presume will be a painful neuroma, particularly for that quote causalgic nerve, by essentially completing a neurectomy, so transecting the nerve, and then placing it within a muscle, dunking it within muscle, with the thought that that nerve will just kind of grow into that portion of muscle and it won't become a painful neuroma. Some would argue that if you're placing that nerve into innervated muscle, it won't grow into it. It won't get the chemotactic feedback that it needs to grow. But, really you're trying to, I won't say put a cap on it, but you're trying to give it something to live in so that it doesn't get irritated, at least mechanically. It clearly can still have the chemical irritation because it's trying to regrow.
Yeah, I think that has been my personal strategy as well. I see this kind of patient, certainly some are post-operative for any and every type of surgery. it could be pinning of the distal radius. It could be something more advanced with treatment of the distal radius, but also just from blunt trauma. And in those blunt trauma patients, and I'm thinking of a few work comp patients specifically, you know, I do try conservative means, but if I don't, I'm not successful. I'd love your thoughts. I mean, my general first step is exploration and neurolysis. And I have to say, I couldn't give you a success rate for that. So I don't know whether, I guess in my mind, it still makes sense to consider that, you know, freeing the nerve from scar tissue and hoping that it gets better. But it's certainly not an 80% success rate. And often I am back with a second surgery, which is more of the dunking the nerve and muscle. What's your thought on a neurolysis in those kind of patients?
Well, you know, I think that the options I give the patient are neurolysis versus some kind of neuroma treatment that's more definitive that involves a neurectomy, essentially, and then something else. And we'll talk about, you know, kind of what I did. But, you know, I think that if you offer them a neurolysis, there's the possibility of recurrence. And then I know there's going to be some people that say, well, why don't you wrap it? You know, and stuff. I think wraps, and I think our partner, David Bergen, has proven this with some recent studies, wraps are bad. And so many nerve surgeons anecdotally will tell you that wraps are bad. And I know that there are some big advocates for some kind of barrier, but I think that they create more scar. And I know that's going to be an unpopular opinion, and I'm probably going to lose some opportunities because of that.
Well, first of all, I'm sorry if you lose opportunities, but I have heard that from people wiser than me in the treatment of nerves over and over and over. And it'll be interesting to see if our audience has comments on the use of wraps. And I hope they, if they do have comments, they share. I've never done it. I've always heard that wraps really don't have a place. I believe that. And so I get the, this is the ultimate challenge with industry relations. And it is what it is. You have to call it the way you see it.
Well, you know, the in theory, the wraps are great. You know, you have some kind of barrier to prevent the nerve from scarring is fantastic. I think the most reliable barrier that I've seen is the one, you know, there are two reliable barriers. One of them is, you know, placing it in a very wide cuff of adipose, so like an adipofascial kind of barrier, which that's my go-to for a subcutaneous transposition, is that adipofascial pedicled fat that's just subdermal and just proximal to the antecubital fossa that was described by the group at Columbia University. And then, you know, you can also use a vein autograft. And if it's available to you, I guess a vein allograft, but that's not really widely available. But a vein autograft, as described, I think, by Dean Satirianos, using it almost as a barber pole so that the intima is surrounding loosely that nerve and everything will scar to the vein, but you keep a plane between the epineurium and the intima of that vein. So those are the two that I'll use. I've used that latter option in revision tarsal tunnel surgery, which I know is far from the upper hand podcast, but it's worked out well in the times where I have to do it. You know, if I offer a patient a neurectomy type procedure, I tell them you're going to be numb, and that's the plan. And most people are willing to trade their very bad nerve-related pain for the numbness, and the diagnostic block gives them a sense of what that's going to be like.
Yeah, I think that's well said. And I certainly would not argue or disagree with you on any of that.
So fast forward a couple of years, and we are, you know, we talked about exploration and had the standard neuroma treatment, like a conversation like we just had. So we explore, and I find the neuroma, the bulbous firm thing that was seen on ultrasound and responded well to an image-guided injection. And it's the SRN, just deep to the brachioradialis in the, it's in, I guess at this point, the junction of the middle third and two-thirds of the forearm. And we dissected proximally, and we beautifully saw, we confirmed that it was the SRN and not the LABC because of the depth. And also then I saw the PIN coming off. But then in between, we saw this really nice ECRB branch coming off of the SRN, not coming off of the radial nerve proper, not coming off of the PIN, which I know they're pretty even split on the variations on how that comes off. So we did targeted muscle reinnervation. So, you know, we did the neurectomy and then had a lot of redundancy. And, you know, since that ECRB branch was coming off of the SRN anyway, it wasn't purely, quote, a sensory nerve. And we just did a nerve transfer, and I have a good sense this is going to be very helpful for this patient.
All right, two things for both. I'll blame it on the audience. Two things for our audience, which in parentheses means really clarify for Chuck. First, did the patient complain of or have any concerns whatsoever about his or her numbness and the dorsal first web space?
Wanted the pain gone.
It's so loved, interesting, right?
Loved how it felt after the, you know, after the lidocaine only injection. I didn't use any steroid. The reason not to use steroid, in my opinion, is that, you know, the work that you and Ryan have done in terms of flare reactions, I don't want any possibility that anything other than an optimal response to that injection is related to a potential flare.
Yeah, interesting. And then when you state, you tell us exactly what you did. You cut out the neuroma distal to the branch point of the ECRB motor branch. And then what'd you do?
So after doing that, I trimmed back further on the superficial radial nerve just to make sure I'm in super healthy fascicles. And then I divided the branch to the ECRB as it came off of the more proximal part of the SRN, and then co-opted the SRN to the ECRB branch with the idea of, you know, targeted muscle reinnervation, which we probably should do an episode on. But the theory is that by giving that SRN proximal stump something to grow into and something to do, you are giving that nerve a function, you're giving it purpose, and it will not become chemically and mechanically irritated because it will regrow into this now denervated, freshly denervated ECRB.
Well, awesome stuff. I have to admit, I've been intrigued by this targeted muscle reinnervation, which is becoming, you know, more spoken about and more, I guess, popular, if that's the right word. I agree, we should do an episode on that for sure.
And then the other thing I think that I've, you know, obviously I did feel great about, you know, cutting the branch to ECRB. We did make sure there was another wrist extensor branch using the handheld nerve stimulator prior to the tourniquet being up for too long. So,
yeah, that's a great point. It would have been awkward to make the decision to take that. But if ultimately that's going to take care of the patient's pain, which I'm sure it did and will. And you also said one other thing, which was interesting. Fast forward a couple of years. So this patient lived with this neuroma, lived with the pain for years, and then came back and said, help me.
Polytrauma patient had a lot of other stuff going on.
Gotcha. All right. Should we jump into the episode?
Yes. I feel like I've gotten my nerve itch scratched, so I think we're good to go. So let's talk about something else. We haven't done one of these non-medical type topics for a while, so let's get into it.
Yeah, we had talked about finance. And while I feel like we need a disclosure here, Chuck and Chris do not have a license to give financial advice to anyone, including each other, but we're going to share our financial thoughts with you.
Yet every year the fellows want to get a finance talk from you, a personal finance talk, I should say, not a practice management finance talk.
I enjoy talking about finance. I think the very basic thoughts that we're going to discuss today are pretty straightforward. But yet we don't really think about them as surgeons. And I hope and believe that the comments we're going to make today are applicable to all listeners because they're what I would call conservative and reasonable and hopefully helpful. I mean, maybe we should start as we, you know, think about our trainees going out into the world soon. What doctors have a problem that they tend to overspend. They tend to invest aggressively, and that doesn't always work out so well.
Well, I think a lot of it is the fact that, you know, we are, you know, we expect to have, at least in the US, I'll say this, because doctors are not paid, compensated the same way everywhere. But we're led to believe that this is going to be a glamorous lifestyle. And I will say, especially if you decide to go into a procedural type field. And I think that is compounded by the fact that you have to wait so darn long. You know, I know that in some countries, you know, the path to medical school starts, you know, fresh out of high school. But in the US, oftentimes you are spending 4 years in college and more now with a gap year in between. Then you go to medical school and then you match into your residency. And some of those residencies, you know, orthopedics in the US is 5 years. Some people do a research year, and then something like neurosurgery is even 7 years. And then oftentimes people will do a fellowship. So while all of your, you know, your friends and contemporaries who are in college go out and perhaps start earning money at the age of 25, and even sooner, actually, you are waiting until you're in your 30s. And that has its own set of issues.
Yeah, all good points. And especially if you have loans to repay, not only are you living, not a terrible lifestyle while you're a resident or a fellow, but certainly not a glamorous lifestyle by any stretch, but you're not repaying your loans. And so those are hanging over your head and come due later. You're not typically saving for the future. So you're just kind of getting by typically until you go into practice. And then all of a sudden you go into practice and you're not going to be making $1 million a year by any stretch, but you're going to have money. And for some, that's when the problems start.
Mm-hmm. And before we get to that point, I want to confess something.
Uh-oh.
I still have a lot of student loans. And so my wife does too. And at the beginning of residency, we were paying back our student loans like you're supposed to. And then in the middle of my residency, we just sat down and said, you know what? Screw that. Let's go into deferment. We went into deferment because we wanted to spend the money on experiences. We wanted to travel. We were, you know, we were able to coordinate our vacations and stuff. We didn't have any kids. And we were living in New York City, so it was easy to go places. This was obviously pre-pandemic and you were flying everywhere and it was worth it. I'm still paying for them now, so maybe it would have been the smarter financial move. But I think everything we're going to say is, you know, you want to be financially savvy, but you need to live your life to a certain extent and get the experiences that that you'll remember.
There is no doubt that you are correct. And living in New York City is, you know, makes it easy to travel, but also just makes it easy to spend money. I mean, trying to live a quiet, conservative lifestyle in New York and just go to work, that would be tough for 5 years if you were.
And spend money in New York, we did. So, but always within our means, of course.
Yeah, it's so interesting. The cost of living factors of St. Louis versus the coast is very different. And that's one of the reasons that life is a little more straightforward in the Midwest and in other parts of the country that are not super high cost of living.
So let's dive in. Tell me, I think that you are the kind of person that likes to offer seven pearls for things, as the podcast has shown us. So what's your first pearl?
Yeah, so the first pearl is, I guess, a little complex. We in medicine, and again, that includes all comers, may think we're smarter than other people. And first of all, I don't necessarily buy that that's true. I mean, look, we just talked about spending all these years in training in our prime of our life. I don't know if that makes us smarter or not. But the reality is, I think many doctors believe they get investing and can do better than the next person. And I just don't buy it. And so my first pearl, which again, should resonate to most, is find a financial advisor. Because I don't think we can, quote unquote, compete in the stock market or understand many of the issues around investing without support. There are people that do this full time every day, understand things in a way that we never will. How could I, a busy surgeon, think that I'll pick the right stock and go make a lot of money? I just don't buy it.
I think some of it is that many of us have the concern that we are going to get fleeced by a financial advisor and that they are going to take advantage of the fact that we don't know anything, which some of them do. There are very different strategies. You know, I think that, understanding the way that your financial advisor gets compensated is important, their fee structure. You have to understand that you are going to pay them. Nobody's going to do this for you for free. So you do have to pay for this service. And some of them have conflicts of interest in terms of the products that they're pushing. There are some that, you know, will invest in the market with different strategies. And there are others that will use things like life insurance products as investment vehicles. And, you know, there's all sorts of complexities there that you really need to try to understand. When I was trying to educate myself early on, I bought a Suze Orman book that was recommended. And that was helpful to me to at least understand how to approach this and find a financial advisor that at least, you know, aligned with what we thought our philosophy was going to be.
Yeah, I think your last point resonates. First of all, if you have a significant other, hopefully and ideally you can talk about these issues in a very upfront fashion and make decisions like you described in your residency, where you decided to put their loan repayment on hold and move forward with life. I think this type of decision of choice of a financial advisor and strategy to that financial advisor are really important. I would just say for me, the one that makes no sense is a commission-based financial advisor. And so I don't know about you, but we have essentially, we pay fees to our financial advisor based on assets under management. So they take a percent of all the money which they manage for us, which, you know, if things are good, I don't mind that at all. But if it's a down year for the stock market and our portfolio drops and I still have to pay that percent, that really feels awkward. But I think in the long run, it still pays off.
I think many times we've talked about our personal experiences with our family. And one of the reasons why we've chosen to use a financial advisor is because my father still thinks that he is smarter than everybody else out there and still does this on his own. And I still remember the tribulations, you know, surrounding, you know, the drops after 9/11 and then 2008 and hearing about it from my dad and hearing the stock selections. And maybe he is smarter than everybody else, but I just didn't want to deal with the stress of that. So I found a financial advisor and we're going with it.
And that is so true. I think when I was a kid, my father, similar to yours, I think thought he could do this and do it well. And I think probably he largely did, but there was some worldwide crisis going on. I remember this very serious conversation when there's chaos, you know, gold is a great protected environment. He invested in gold and gold went to hell. it's never that simple. Like, we are not smarter than the system. It just, cryptocurrency is a great example. I find it interesting and I would sort of like to invest in it, but I haven't done it. I just, again, don't think I can be ahead of the curve. And the other thing I'll say is, and I think hopefully everyone will appreciate this, we all hear about people's stock market successes. I bought Amgen when it was $2 a share, and now it's $7,000 a share. You know, we all hear those stories. We don't hear the stories on the other end where people buy something and it goes to hell. I will say pretty strongly, with rare exception, I do not buy individual stocks anymore because I just, again, don't think I can do it successfully. Unless I understand that I'm sort of gambling. It's like going to Vegas.
It's like when people show cases at meetings, you always show your best case. Like, yeah, we all know that. Nobody shows the TMRs that fail, for example, as we just talked about. That being said, before we move to our next point, I would like next year's variable compensation to be paid in Bitcoin. So just put that into my new agreement, okay?
That just brings up, oh my God, it's just so crazy. That's the Tesla model, right? For about 2 weeks, and then it wasn't.
And then it wasn't. So does getting paid in Bitcoin get you around tax planning? So that's your next pearl here.
Oh gosh. I think, you know, tax planning is, for me, the same deal. If you manage your money well, there are different ways to, you know, consider investments and consider the future and accept the reality that we pay a lot of taxes. And obviously, tax rates are incremental based on earned income. And many doctors fall into that highest tax bracket. And so at one point I could manage my own taxes, and now I just think it's too complicated.
Yeah, I finally started using a CPA. It was that time, mainly because of some of the consulting stuff and having an LLC for that. I just didn't want to mess it up. It was starting to get a little too complex for me. And I think that, you know, in the end, it probably did save me money. Even though I paid for it, it does save you money in the end to have somebody help you understand the tax strategies. Now clearly we pay our fair share of taxes, but there are ways, you know, like deferred compensation and other ways to decrease your taxable income. And all of this sounds kind of hoity-toity, but, you know, I think it's important to consider.
I think that's well said. Look, I don't mind paying my fair share, and that's why some people would label me a happy Democrat. But I will pay my fair share, but I want to do it correctly. The first two points, you know, the financial advisor and the CPA, those are things where those of us listening who tend to run our own show, whether that be in the OR or in clinic or wherever, we have to trust. And for me, that was a barrier, still is. You have to ultimately find the right person you connect with and trust that they will lead you in the right direction.
Speaking of trust, one thing I've heard is that it's very expensive to get a divorce.
I think that is, yeah. So choose your significant other and your spouse wisely. I think there's no greater mistake financially that we can make than to get a divorce.
Well, your third pearl, you know, centers around, risk management and planning and all that kind of stuff. What does that entail?
Again, everyone's approach will be different. Some couples separate their finances. My wife and I certainly have not. But you do need to think about, the future. And so setting up trusts, which are a little foreign to me, but again, with the right CPA and the right financial advisor, that can be done. That protects your assets in the event of an adverse event. And it is a way to consider your legacy with your children and with giving and things like that. So that's part one. And then do the little things right. Don't skimp on certain things like car insurance. And this is coming from someone who just had an adverse event with my car. You don't skimp on those things because they can come back to bite you. And so, have a reputable insurance company and get the right limits on auto insurance and home insurance and those kind of things.
It's interesting. We went through that estate planning kind of process and setting up a family trust because we were advised to do so. And I love the fact that lawyers can bill for emails. I mean, I don't love that for me, but the learning that you can bill for emails, like, I need to start doing that somehow.
It's incredible, right? I make so many calls to patients and answer emails of patients. And I just think it's part of my job, but clearly I wasn't cut out to be an attorney.
Well, that's why doctors are chumps when it comes to that kind of stuff, right? And I think a lot of our therapy colleagues spend a lot of time with documentation and patient communication that is largely uncompensated as well. So that's a whole different conversation, right?
Yes. And each of these points could be expanded. We're just trying to hit the highlights. And if this discussion resonates, we could dive deeper into some of these or invite a guest, which I think could be interesting.
Absolutely.
The fourth pearl is around college, which is, again, a little foreign to Chris right now, but it is in my wheelhouse. I have a senior in college. I have a soon-to-be freshman in college, and I have my youngest is in high school. 529 plans are, to me, just incredibly valuable. You can deduct donations from your state taxes, and the money grows without paying taxes, and you withdraw tax-free to help pay for college. It is really, really a great thing. And you don't have to use your own state's 529 plan. There are different choices. In fact, there's a lot of choices, which can get confusing going back to the financial advisor. But 529 plans for college planning really make sense.
Well, you say that it's foreign to me right now, but not really, because every meeting we have with our financial advisors, that's one of the big ticket items because it's so darn expensive. They always say the tuition bubble on universities and colleges is going to pop, but it hasn't because they've been saying that for a long time. And I can't remember the actual number, but the projected tuition that they give us is astronomical. And I'm sure, rewind 15 years when you were at my stage, you were thinking about how much this is going to cost you too. One thing I will say is, sometimes that is a consideration when you're looking at jobs, right? Because there are some universities that have, tuition benefits for your dependents. Some people say those are the golden handcuffs of WashU.
Well, there is no doubt it is a nice thing for us at WashU. Certainly, it's not a full tuition compensation plan, but it's a remarkably valuable benefit. No doubt about it.
There are some places that do more than WashU and some places that do less. But that is something to consider, I think, is if you're a trainee and you're looking at positions and you do happen to be looking at a university, something you may want to keep in mind because that ends up being real dollars if you end up staying at that place, the long haul.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. The next item is thinking about retirement. And it, you know, there are lots of stats and data out there about when you start retiring has an incredible effect on what your retirement dollars will look like. And so those who start saving, even small dollars, if you start saving early during residency, for example, it makes a huge difference down the road. And so every type of practice for every type of healthcare provider has an option for a retirement plan. At WashU, it's called a 403B. And there are other vehicles as well, like IRAs for ancillary income and things like that. So all I would say is you should make your best effort at fully funding your retirement and maybe do some more beyond that, but at least fully fund your retirement from day one.
You know, as you know, we always think in, at least in the United States with medical training, that our, you know, we start saving for retirement once you become an attending. One thing that you can do as a trainee when you're a resident and you have a paycheck at least is consider a Roth IRA. You know, again, this is not, we don't give financial advice, but you will eventually not be able to contribute to a Roth IRA because your income will exceed the limits of that likely. But if you start early, you know, the for this and both the college planning discussion, I mean, the biggest, you know, one of the most powerful forces in the world is compound interest. I think that's a Buffett thing. I don't know. But you know, that's an important point.
Well said. This next one's for you, Chris. Manage your debt. And that could be college or medical school debt. That could be credit card debt. Just do your darndest not to have it. It just wears you down. And the fees and the interest you pay can be excessive. And there are ways to manage it. And refinancing homes. And there's all kind of crazy ways that we are in no position to recommend, but try to get rid of debt.
Agree 100%. But I will say that I had the opportunity to just pay off my loans, my student loans. And emotionally, that probably would have felt pretty good. But the interest rate is so darn good on it that it is less than, you know, so the interest rate on the loans is less than the anticipated return from investing in the market. So at that point, it actually makes more sense for me to put that money in the market. And then I'm fortunate enough to be in a loan repayment program from the NIH. So they're paying some of that, you know, some of that student loan debt off. So thank you, taxpayers, again. I've thanked the taxpayers before. That being said, I do have to pay taxes on the amount that the NIH pays to pay off my loans, which is kind of a kick in the pants.
Yeah, I don't know about you, and I certainly don't want to put words in your mouth, but I was given a gift from my family that I did not have student debt. And that is probably one of my driving principles. I want to return that to my children. And so that is a huge goal of mine. And, you know, so far I'm doing okay, but grad schools and other things might be a challenge, but that is a primary goal for me.
So back to our earlier conversation about my parents and my dad anticipating the market, that was the plan. That was the plan. And then 2008 hit, and then it was not the plan. So it's fine. But yes, that is also a goal of mine too, the same one that you have. But yeah, stuff doesn't always work out.
It does not. All right. Number seven is just a bit of a grab bag, which I think is kind of fun to talk through quickly. So the first one, and we can go back and forth. The first is, again, don't think you're smarter than the next guy, because in all likelihood, financially, you're not. So no exotic investments, no Bitcoin right now, unless you're willing to lose that money. Just play it safe, index funds and financial advisor recommended investments. Individual stocks are tough and exotic investments are tougher. Play it safe.
There are going to be so many people that are like, God, these academic people are so conservative. Why don't they, you know, spend some money, you know, take some chances? I guarantee we have listeners that are like, nope, that is not my strategy. I'm going for it. I'm investing everything on so-and-so stock. And I don't have the stomach for that. Like I work is stressful enough, you know, I just don't want to deal with that. And that's, I don't see it's where financial people make their money, right? It's like from people like us, I guess. But you know, what are your thoughts about, you know, things like a boat or a vacation home or all that kind of stuff, the stuff that's tempting when you want to live the life when you've quote made it?
Yeah, it's not been a priority for us. And I think that's a personal choice. If you have the money, and I would emphasize that, if you have the money and the stomach for a major purchase, and it is important for your lifestyle, and it's important, you should spend some money sometimes. It's not all about saving. And like you said, travel, et cetera. Look, it's just a personal choice, which we will all consider differently. It's not been a priority for me, but I understand why it is for others.
Yeah, no, I'd rather spend that money on a gluttonous amount of food at some fancy restaurant, to be honest with you. But maybe one day we'll change. I think it's funny how you wrote on your outline, don't no exotic investments. And my immediate thought was, don't buy tigers. So I guess I have some Joe Exotic on my mind. But
that's hilarious.
Flashback to the early stages of the pandemic.
That's exactly right. And then, you know, the last one's credit cards, which we touched on. You know, don't have credit card debt. And there are good credit card offers out there that you have to be savvy to, where you get, you know, real money back every purchase you make. Those are getting into the weeds. But I think there's all kind of little choices like that, which seem little, that add up in the end.
Well, again, we don't give financial advice, but, you know, there are ways to use credit cards to your benefit, you know, aside from what you described. I mean, you know, there's a period of time, at least in the US, like after you finish an orthopedic residency, you know, presumably in the middle of June or the end of June, you don't start your fellowship until August 1st. So you have a month or 6 weeks where you are technically unemployed and you don't have any money coming in, and you may not have saved appropriately for paying for a move. And I remember during that stage, we took out a credit card that had a 0% APR for a year. So we used that essentially to pay for all the moving stuff. And then once we started having paychecks again, paid everything back. But it was like a free loan. But you clearly have to use that responsibly and not let that get away from you. Again, we're not giving financial advice, but I think that's probably the most disclaimers we've ever had on the podcast. But well, we are so out of our element right now that...
It'll be interesting to see if we get any comments, and I hope we do. And a lot of people may be thinking, stick to medical stuff, you guys.
Exactly. Well, that was fun. I will say that during the last 2/3 of recording this podcast, my son has been trying to make himself breakfast. So I need to get back to him because I've seen a lot of things come out of the cupboard and I have no idea what's going on in the kitchen.
Sounds like a serious risk to the home. Take care of those assets.
Talk about risk management.
All right. Have a great day.
You too. Take care. Bye.
Hey, Chris, that was fun. Let's do it again real soon.
Sounds good. Well, be sure to check us out on Twitter at Hand Podcast. Hey, Chuck, what's your Twitter handle?
Mine is at Congenital Hand. What about you?
Mine is at Chris DMD, spelled DY. And if you'd like to email us, you can reach us at handpodcast@gmail.com.
And remember, please subscribe wherever you get your podcast.
And be sure to leave a review. That helps us get the word out.
Special thanks to Peter Martin for the amazing music. And remember, keep the upper hand and come back next time.